Four Hit Parade, starring Frank Sinatra.
Who knows what evil lurks in the hearts of men?
And now, smile a while with Lorenzo Jones and his wife, Belle.
Here's the Manhattan merry-go-round that brings you the bright side of life, that whirls you in music to all the big night spots of New York town, to hear the top songs of the week sung so clearly you can understand every word and sing them yourself.
This is the Golden Age of Radio. I'm Dick Bertel, and tonight we'll take you on another audio excursion back to radio's formative years. You'll hear the programs that made the era golden, and meet people who made those broadcasts a reality.
The Golden Age of Radio is brought to you by WTIC and Cromwell Savings Bank, an equal housing lender located at Main and West Streets in Cromwell. Tonight's guest is the well-known radio and motion picture actor, Robert Cumming. Dick and his guest will join you in just a moment.
Get growing. Get growing. You can count the difference when you're growing.
Cromwell Savings Bank of Cromwell.
Unexpected financial needs arise in everyone's life at one time or another. The folks at Cromwell Savings Bank understand this and are ready to help you meet your needs no matter how large or small. Auto loans, personal loans, or educational loans can all be arranged quickly and easily by Cromwell Savings Bank. They're open Monday through Wednesday, 9 to 3, Thursdays, 9 to 5, and Fridays, 9 to 7:30.
You grow more with us.
Cromwell Savings Bank of Cromwell.
Cromwell Savings Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender located at Main and West Streets in Cromwell. And now, your host, Dick Bertel.
Thank you and good evening. And with me is radio collector, historian, Ed Corcoran. And Ed, our guest tonight is certainly no stranger to radio, but I think perhaps people will recognize him more readily as having been on the motion picture screen and on their television sets.
Yes, Dick, and we're certainly very pleased to have that fabulous actor and personality, Robert Cummings.
Bob, it's awfully good to have you here on the program.
Thank you, Richard. I hear you in the bathroom all the time, and it's so nice to see you in person.
Well, good. I'm glad you carry that portable radio around with you.
It's the only place it works.
Well, Bob, I am just amazed to learn that you did so much radio at the start of your career. As a matter of fact, you said that you did start out in radio.
I started out on radio because it was during the height of the Depression, about 1931. Englishmen were in demand. I went to England and came back as an Englishman, although I'm from Joplin, Missouri. And I changed my name to Blade Stanhope Conway, worked my way over on a boat as a waiter, worked my way back. And I told them that I was Blade Stanhope Conway, the youngest actor, author, manager, director, producer in England. And I was coming to America for a short visit. I wasn't particularly interested in the money, but I wanted the experience of playing before American audiences. And 3 days later, I was starred in Galsworthy's The Roof, for Charles Hopkins, who was producing it, and John Galsworthy directed it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's a most auspicious beginning for a young fellow who was just barely 21 years old from Joplin, Mo, who hadn't wanted to be an actor in the first place. But it was any port in a storm, and so that was the first blush. Now, after that, body and soul was held together by radio. I worked on the Dick Gordon show as Sherlock Holmes when he played Sherlock Holmes. No, most people won't remember that. I worked on the Baby Rose Marie show. And years and years and years later, she worked on the Bob Cummings show.
We're very good friends. That's right.
I was Milton Berle's straight man, and I worked with him on the Gillette Razor Blade Hour. He cut his throat on the air. Then I worked on the first episode of the first Jack Benny-sponsored show. It was the Chevrolet program, I believe.
Even before Jell-O then, huh?
Yeah, and then I was on the first Fred Allen episode, the Linnet Bathtub Hour, I believe it was called.
Mm-hmm, that's right.
And I sang a commercial or something as an Englishman. I was a very unimportant.
I was going to say, were you appearing as Bob Cummings or an actor?
Oh, my God, I wouldn't tell anybody I was Bob Cummings. No, because that would have ruined the whole thing, because if people were not in demand at this time, it's an awful commentary on the United States. An Englishman could come from abroad and work here, and people revered him. And that was the time on Broadway when there were 23 shows, I believe, running. Ed Wrong Way Corcoran here will understand that, won't you, Ed?
Oh, yes.
You remember that?
I remember.
That was the 23 shows running on Broadway. 19 were British. Barretts of Wimple Street, Berkeley Square, Good Companions, Journey's End, The Devil Passes, Death Takes a Holiday was not English, but they used English actors, Noel Coward's Private Lives. And that, those were the days when Leslie Howard and Ronald Coleman and Charlie Lawton and Brian Ahern and so many of the great actors came and started in the theater here. They had no tax problem. They had no problems at all. Give us your halt, you're blind, you're poor, and come send them over, and we'll starve our own people. That was the great thing. They were still doing it. So I said, well, you know, if I can't get a job as an American, then I'll join the crowd of Englishmen that are being influxed into this country. And just about that time, Actors' Equity was being formed. In fact, it had been formed. And they put a kibosh. What does that mean? they put a stop to this influx of alien actors by saying that you had to pay 20% of your salary, I believe, to Actors' Equity and wait 6 months between engagements. So there was a setup all for me, and I didn't tell anybody. I went to England on the ship, stayed there 29 days, came back, wrote letters saying whom I was, and 3 days later I was starred. Much to my amazement, and I almost died. I opened, I got pretty good notices, and I've been a star ever since, of sorts.
But you weren't using that name when you came back, were you? Or
Blade
were you?
Stanhope Conway.
Really?
And I didn't realize something. The initials of Blade Stanhope Conway are B.S. Conway. I didn't know that. And it took me about 2 years after I used it to find out what I was really saying.
When did you go back to the name Robert Cummings?
Well, that was when I signed up for the Ziegfeld Follies, and the Schuberts had taken it over after Ziggy died. Ziggy had cast the show and sent it out on the road with Fanny Bryce and William Eugene Howard and Everett Marshall and Jane Froman and Patricia Bowman, a great cast. And they were projecting it to be opened in, I think they played here, believe it or not, in Hartford. They were going to open it at the Winter Garden Theater, and it was a lousy show. So they had it redirected by John Murray Anderson.
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing I can remember all his names. And John Murray Anderson said, look, we have to get a different type of young leading man. And he searched around. He said, I would like an Englishman. And somebody called and said, are you British? And I said, unfortunately, yes. They said, come over right away. So I went over, met John Murray Anderson. They gave me the worst song in the show to sing, and because I was the last man on the totem pole.
You don't remember the name of it, do
yes,
you?
Yes. I Like the Likes of You, which became the hit song of the Ziegfeld Follies. And strangely enough, because of that song, although I don't smoke, and I advise other people not to, Lucky Strike Cigarettes took that photo. Well, I had nothing to do with it. They sold me and the girl in the show to Lucky Strikes to photograph. And they took a photo of me handing her a cigarette, and it said, I Like the Likes of You. That photo went on 24 sheets all over the country. And from that, I became semi-well-known, believe it or not. It's hard. But everywhere you looked, you saw this cigarette ad, I Like the Likes of You. And people used to come up and say, aren't you the fellow on the Lucky Strike cigarette ad? Just give me a cigarette, things like that.
And you didn't tell them by any chance you didn't smoke, did you?
No, of course I did. You know, I've always been too frank, too open. I'm like Jimmy Cagney. I'm a professional beginner. Finally, one day after working for almost 5 years on Broadway, that show with the Ziegfeld Follies went to the coast in California. But by this time, the English craze had collapsed. You couldn't get a job now if you were an Englishman, because the Jimmy Cagney era had come in, hit the girl in the face with a grapefruit.
Been British-like.
Edward G. Robinson, the gangster era, Paul Mooney.
George Raft.
And then if you weren't that type, then you were the tall, long, lanky type like Gary Cooper and Randy Scott and that type. So you had to either be a Texan or a gangster. And, boy, I was out of style. So I came to the coast, and one day I heard about a part at Paramount. It was for a young Texan. So I gritted my teeth, worked all night listening to Spade Cooley or somebody on the air, on radio. And I came in the next day as a Texan from San Angelo, Texas. And I said that I hadn't had any experience, but I sure would like to try, because I just know that I could just knock a tar out of this park. I really didn't know how to do a Texas accent and still don't. And they hired me, and so I was starred opposite Margaret Sullivan in So Red the Rose at Paramount, and I've been a star ever since in that field. And if they won't star me, to hell with them.
Bob, you don't play Texans anymore, do you?
I did.
Did you really?
Just this last summer I played a fellow named Herbert Farquhart. It's a play called What Are You Doing in My Life, written by Frank Tashlin, the famous director from Hollywood. He wrote it for me, and Jenny Bowles, she played the girl. We played four parts. I played the writer, who was married to this actress. Then later on, she plays the actress's stand-in or friend, and I play a man who comes to buy the house in Beverly Hills, Herbert Farquhart, who is a Texan. I tell you, I never seen anything like this in my life. It almost sounded like
Spade Cooley.
Pyle.
Yeah, Gomer Pyle.
Gomer Pyle, you know. I don't know what accent I used. But whatever it was pretty nauseating.
But it worked.
It worked.
When did you play Robert Cummings then,
I became Bob Cummings right away, because I had to then hide my English background and not let anybody know, which also meant I took a duck in salary. And then I've done how many pictures? 112 pictures, I think, all together. And some of them were made in New York before I went to Hollywood, but as an Englishman. But I think in all that time that I have never... Well, yes, I have. I played Englishmen. Two or three times I played English parts. I played Texans and all that. But for the most part, I've just played Bob Cummings, Joplin, Missouri-type fellow.
Well, that has been our good fortune, I think. Ed, it's about time we heard Bob Cummings from Joplin, Missouri, in one of those big radio shows that he appeared in. And, Bob, I know you did so many of them. What are you going to play for us?
Well, I have one from the Lux Radio Theater, a show called What a Woman, with Bob Starr with a local girl. You remember her name? From Waterbury, Connecticut?
Waterbury, the Roz Russell.
Roz Russell,
yes,
that's right.
Another Gemini.
That's right. And this one, I guess you didn't play the part in the movies. It was played by Brian Ahern. But
mm-hmm. Those Englishmen got everything.
Yeah, even that late date. And you played it somewhat differently, I suppose. You didn't actually ape the way he did it. You probably did it your own way, I would assume, when you did that show.
Well, we'll find out.
I don't even remember doing it. I remember Roz Russell.
15 years ago. Okay, Nick, let's roll the tape.
From coast to coast, a sensational new novel is sweeping America. Its title, The Whirlwind, stares from every bookshelf. And the name of Anthony Street, its author, is on every tongue. Right now, in an office of a Knickerbocker magazine.
Well, Henry, you can forget that article on Anthony Street.
What do you mean, forget it?
Because there is no Anthony Street. It's a pen name. I just talked to the publisher. The author of The Whirlwind doesn't want himself known.
Wait a minute. He writes the best-selling novel in 10 years and doesn't want himself known? What's the matter with him?
I don't know. But the next best thing to Anthony Street is the person who did more than anyone else to put that book over. Carol Ainslie.
Carol Ainslie? She's Anthony Street's agent?
Anthony Street hasn't any agent. But Carol Ainslie thought it was going to be a bestseller, hooked up with the publishers, and did the best promotion job in the history of the business.
And all for her usual 10%. So what?
I'm sorry to bore you, Henry, but Carol Ainslie happens to be phenomenal. And our readers will want to know about her.
Well, they want to know about Anthony Street.
But they'll settle for Carol Ainslie. She's all over the newspapers, isn't she? This search to find an unknown male to play the whirlwind in the movies?
she some relative of Senator Ainslie?
His daughter. Important background, everything. What more do you want for an article?
Well, me? Nothing. I don't even want to read it.
I'm afraid you will, because you're going to write it.
Oh, now, just a minute.
Carol Ainslie's going to be in our next issue, so grab your hat and get over to her office.
Are you serious?
Get over there!
You're serious.
You're...
Everybody's here, Miss Aisley. Anytime you want to begin.
Thanks, Timmy. Come on into my office, everyone.
Well, I guess you all know where I've been. Atlanta and Memphis, Chicago, St. Louis, Boston.
Harold, you found the whirlwind?
Are you kidding? My notes read like a coroner's report.
Oh, great.
Now, look, everyone. When a certain motion picture producer named David Arthur bought the screen rights to the whirlwind, I made it part of the contract that we'd supply the man to play the part. Fine, great. Only now, Mr. Arthur's becoming a little unreasonable. He insists that we deliver him. Well, where do we stand?
Absolutely nowhere. Sorry, Carol.
I won't believe it. I simply cannot believe in all these United States that there isn't a man who can play the whirlwind. What's more, I don't think that we... Timmy, there in the corner, with his hat on, who is he?
I thought he came in with you.
With me?
Excuse me, I'll get your phone. Hello?
You there, you with the hat on?
Yes.
You're new here, aren't you?
Well, as a matter of fact,
it's Hollywood again, Miss Ainsley. David Arthur.
What did I say to him?
You're never any good when you rehearse. Here, talk to him.
David! Oh, darling. Well, I know, but there isn't anything to worry about. Well, I have two wonderful possibilities. One of them is bound to pan out. I'll deliver him when and as I promised. Oh, David, now don't worry about it. I'll keep you posted on everything that happens. Just give my love to Sophie. That's right, darling. Bye. Oh, how did I do?
Got us a reprieve.
Well, we can't hold him off forever. Oh, well, thanks, everyone. That's all for now. Oh, you with a hat on. Are you bald?
Bald?
And just what do you do in this firm?
Yeah, you see, I don't work here. No, I'm a spy.
Oh, I see. But who are you spying on and what for?
Well, on you for Knickerbocker Magazine.
A reporter? And you've been sitting there listening to everything
I've... It's a very colorful business you run, Miss Ainsley.
Thank you. What is your name?
Pepper. Henry Pepper.
Do you ever take your hat off, Mr. Pepper?
Only in recognition of exceptional achievement, Miss Ainsley.
But now, just what did you have in mind for your magazine?
Well, the boss wants an article on you.
Oh. Well, I didn't mean to be rude. I'll send for my biography from the publicity department. It covers everything from my childhood.
Well, thanks all the same, Miss Ainsley, but I work in kind of a funny way.
So I gather.
Yes, I work, well, you might say, from the inside. When I'm on an assignment, my subject and I practically, might say, live together.
That's cozy. Mr. Pepper, I happen to be a very busy woman.
And a very smart woman. You can see the value of an article in Knickerbocker. I figure maybe four installments.
Your coffee, Miss Ainsley.
Oh, thanks, Timmy. Just set it down. Oh, do I have your permission to drink this while it's hot?
Oh, sure. Go right ahead.
Thank you.
I'll just catch up on my reading. The Whirlwind by Anthony Street. Now, what's this blurb on the jacket? Mr. Street is author, soldier, sailor, a man of the world, with a sense of the world in conflict, a tidal wave of action, 6'4" of magnificent manhood, ex-athlete, ex-footballer.
Let me see that. Man of the world with a sense of the world in conflict, 6'4", right under our noses. Oh, Timmy, get me Anthony Street's publishers. Tidal wave of action, 6'4" of magnificent manhood.
Do you mean to say that you haven't seen him?
No, of course not. Anthony Street's his pen name. Everything was arranged through his publishers. And you keep that out of the Knickerbocker.
Mr. Lindsay, Miss Ainsley.
Hello, Lindsay.
Yes?
What's Anthony Street's real name and address?
But Carol, you know I'm on a vow not to reveal...
I don't intend to reveal anything. I just want to have a little talk with him. Now, who is he? And not too loud. I'm not alone.
But I promised. Oh, my. Well, his name is Michael Cobb. He lives in Buxton, Pennsylvania.
Thanks. Timmy, get me a reservation right away for Buxton, Pennsylvania. And now, Mr. Pepper, if you'll excuse me.
You going somewhere?
Out to vote.
More of the Golden Age of Radio in just a moment.
Get growing. You can count the difference when you're growing.
Cromwell Savings Bank of Cromwell.
In days of so much uncertainty, security is welcomed by everyone, especially financial security. The folks at Cromwell Savings Bank suggest that a growing savings account is one of the best means of ensuring financial security, and at Cromwell Savings Bank, you'll grow more with any one of their four savings plans. So begin to plan for tomorrow, today, by opening a savings account at the Cromwell Savings Bank, located at Main and West Streets in Cromwell.
You'll grow more with us.
Cromwell Savings Bank of Cromwell.
Cromwell Savings Bank, member FDIC, is open Monday through Wednesday, 9 to 3, Thursdays, 9 to 5, and Fridays, 9 to 7:30 p.m. Once again, your host, Dick Bertel.
Our guest tonight is Bob Cummings here on the Golden Age of Radio, and Bob, we haven't talked about soap operas, and you were in a soap opera. As a matter of fact, if you let me just take the time to look it up, I can come up with some of the actors who appeared with you. What was the name of the show?
Those We Love. It was on for Pond's Cold Cream, I think.
Mm-hmm. Well, it was Lorene Tuttle, and also the fellow on the Lucy show, Dick.
Nan Gray. Is now married to Donkey Train, or
I was thinking
Mule Train. Yeah.
Nan Gray. She's married to the Tom Harmon, was it?
No. Tom Harmon's married to Elise Knox.
Yeah, that's right.
You're wrong way, Corker.
My reputation is growing by leaps and bounds today.
Well, all right. You're talking about Gail Gordon.
Gail
Gordon. Who's she?
But this is the one, Bob, that surprised me. John Marshall, who probably was the lead in the show, was played at one time by Francis X. Bushman.
No, he played the father.
Oh, did he?
Yeah, Frank Bushman played the father. He was a very good friend of mine. I'd worked in movies with him. Nice man. He was once married to Beverly Baines.
Did this program originate on the coast?
They told me it did. it was right in the little NBC studios there with the water fountain and everything on Hollywood and Vine. No, not Hollywood and Vine. Sunset and Vine, yes.
Mm-hmm. It originated in 1937 on the Blue Network. Do you remember that, Ed?
Vaguely.
Gee, that's 4 or 5 years ago, isn't it?
Then moved over to CBS.
Yes, and that show, unfortunately, has been lost. It's really would be a real collector's item to have a copy of that, because that was really in the early days of soaps, and the cast has gone on to so much better things. You know,
well, there was nothing blue on the Blue Network, I'll tell you. You couldn't even say heck.
That's right.
You couldn't do anything.
No, I think even the CBS, it wasn't until after even the last 10 years that there's been a noticeable change in what you could see on the radio. You never said the word pregnant, did you, ever, when you were on the radio? Not and have a job the next day, anyway.
I was on a show. It's very interesting to me because it was a moment of history and we didn't know it. I was on a show the week after Joseph Cotton had... You see, when they ended the show, the Aroma Wine of Livermore, California presents Suspense. And they'd have a star each week do this thing. I did several of them, The Dead of the Night and two or three others. And Joseph Cotton was on the week before. And everybody was buzzing because they had handed him a piece of paper near the end. They didn't let you know what you were going to announce. And he said... And next week, the Roma Wine Company of Livermore presents a sterling actor, a man who has made his mark. And he went on and on reading about this. And he turned over the page and said, Sonny Tubbs. That's the famous remark that happened on the Roma Wine show.
I had heard this story before, really true, but it is true.
Absolutely true. And I was on the next week, and I didn't realize that was going to become history. Another piece of history, I was rehearsing at WOR in New York about 1932 upstairs across from the Metropolitan Opera, and I was rehearsing Journey's End, playing... Mm-hmm. I can't remember the part I played in it now.
English-type picture, yeah.
And... I looked up the booth we were rehearsing, and everybody in the booth was gone. You know, and I thought, that's strange. And all the other actors, where'd they go? Anybody in there? Nobody answered. And so we went out in the hall, nobody there. And finally people came back laughing, holding their sides, crying, with handkerchiefs stuffed. I said, what happened? What happened? They said, oh, my heavens, you'll never believe it. You won't believe it. This was the day that Uncle
Uncle Don
said his famous line, "That'll hold the little blank blank." At the end of his show, he used to come down on an autogyro, supposedly in radio, land on the roof of WOR, and he said, "Well, good night, kiddies." And he thought the mic was off, and he said, "That'll hold the little blank blank." And I want to tell you, that was the end. I don't know whatever happened to Uncle Don.
The beginning of the end, that's for sure.
Oh. You know, in retrospect, now that we're involved in the business, you can understand perhaps how something like that might happen. Someone could say it in jest, and
I'm sure
it was.
Oh, sure. I'm sure he didn't mean it at all.
No.
It just shows you what no sense of humor the network had. They're scared. They're economic slaves the same as we are. You know?
Yeah, to this day, I'm sure that's the case.
Well, I have some rehearsal tapes that were done, and there's all sorts of profanity going on. You know, an actor misses a cue or doesn't say the right word or something like that. And, you know, that outtakes in movies the same way.
Of course, one of my dearest friends is Harry Von Zell. You know, and he's the one that introduced Herbert Hoover and said, "And now, America, here is Hebert Hoover. Hobby Hooby. Hooby Ho Hooby." I said, "Well, what? Harry, tell me again, Harry." I make him tell me every time. I said, "What happened?" He said, "A very strong arm swept me aside, and Hebe Hobby, Hobie Hoover, Herbert Hoover, stood up there." And he said, "He has no sense of humor. He's like a bull."
That's great.
And I said, "How did you look in those days?" He said, "Like a dehydrated Herbert Hoover."
Well, I'm curious, Bob. Were programs like Suspense, the DuPont Theater, the United States Steel Hour, were they showcases for motion picture actors? In other words,
they paid us a lot of money.
They did pay.
They brought us to New York on trains and sometimes planes. By the time planes came in, they brought us to New York. They would put us up in a hotel. You had to wear a black tie. There was an audience there. And in the case of the Collier's Hour and several others, they had a glass curtain that came down from the top of the proscenium, clear down, so that the audience and the actors and the orchestra or whatever was back at the glass curtain could not be heard at the same time, because they said it was impossible to ever be able to mix the two.
Mm-hmm.
So laughter, they mixed very much like canned laughter. That was at the Amsterdam Roof Theater that had the huge glass curtain. It's still hanging up there. I rehearsed there a few years ago in a play. And we wore a black tie, and they had a green room, and everybody was very ladies and gentlemen and scared to death of executives. And I guess that must have been way back when executives were called vice presidents, and Arthur Godfrey was almost killed by several vice presidents for calling them that.
That's right.
Calling them idiots.
Did you feel going on the mic live was any different than doing some of the other theatric work you were involved in? Did it bother you at all?
It never bothered me, because we didn't know anything else. You see, we didn't make any recordings at all. Everything was live, and boy, the timing and everything had to be just right. Of course, things happened that were incredible, like the Orson Welles. I'm sure you know the story of when he walked on. He didn't like a certain director. There was a personality clash. And this director was so nervous in Hollywood, and he walked out with his script, which had about an inch and a half thick of pages. And they said, I forgot, the Roma Wine Company presents whatever show it was. And he dropped his script, which went off the stage down into a small pit, and was just an irretrievable pile of junk. Nothing would ever retrieve. And the director turned white. It's a wonder he didn't have a heart attack. And just at the moment when Orson is supposed to speak, he reaches in his pocket, pulls out a full one, and of course, things like that happened all the time. But
I've never heard that story.
It wasn't funny to that producer, who finally died, I think.
Not too long after
from that day. It wasn't funny to him, because we were live.
Mm-hmm.
And, it was frightening. Really, in some ways, there was more excitement about it, because you wanted to be as good as you could be, and yet it was hard to get into character, because there were so many people pointing at you, and the sound effects were simply amazing. We don't have that anymore, that marvelous guy who stands there and by blowing his nose or twiggling his toe or something is able to make a sound like a rattlesnake coming through a tin bucket, or I don't know. They could do anything. I don't know how they did it. And that man is there. That's fascinating. Now, you try to stay in character and make love to Roz Russell across the microphone with a man twirling his toe in a tin bucket to sound like a rattlesnake.
Well, on these love scenes, on Looks, did you actually go through any of the motions, especially in comedy roles? Because the audience always seemed to laugh when they were going on, you know.
Yes, we played them. We played them. I'll tell you one time, an example of that. I was doing John Loves Mary, which it was a play written by Norman Krasner. It was for the Theater Guild of the Air. And let me see if I can remember. Oh, yes, there's a scene in it where the boy is caught with his pants off in the living room of this very sedate New York apartment, and the senator walks in, and he's found with the dog. Now, it's perfectly innocent. There's nothing wrong at all. He was changing from his military uniform to his other, and it was no place to go, so he went back to the couch, and at this moment in walked the mother and father. But, it was a last for 5 minutes. We were almost off the air.
That's beautiful. But, of course, you did get the audience to react, and
yes. It
made for a better show.
And once in a while, you would kiss or do something like that. Somebody who, like Loretta Young or Roz Russell, or actresses who are very good friends, and they're almost like your brothers and sisters, these people. And you'd reach across the mic and kiss her or something like that. It gave a lot more reality to what you were playing. And that was the difficulty of staying in character, playing the part, because it was a little like patting your head and rubbing your stomach. Because you're reading, you have to get away from the mic and move back and forth, which becomes automatic after a while. But nevertheless, there was a thing about it that to make the acting as real as possible, you had to be in character, and the other was automatic, the technique of it. Mechanics.
Would the other actor or actress tend to react to you to help you along?
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yes. As a matter of fact, I worked with an actress who shall be nameless, and she despised me. And I didn't know why. I didn't even know she despised me until the thing was over. And she said because of the fact that he kept looking at me all the time we were playing. In other words, I've got the script right here by the mic, and I would look right at her. And they said, well, why was that? She said, because I didn't want to imagine being in love with him. I was imagining my own man, whoever he was.
I think it's about time.
A very poor second choice, I might add.
I thought so.
I think it's about time we heard another selection from your marvelous collection.
Well, Dick, why don't we do a little love scene with Bob and Rosalind Russell, just to show you what the audience, how they reacted. This is from that same show, What a Woman, but... I think you'll notice, as I brought out, that there is a lot of laughter going on. I just wonder how he did it.
All right, we know.
Hello, Miss Ainsley.
Pepper, what's the big idea following me here?
Well, there's a train back to New York at 5:30.
Answer my question.
Well, I thought I explained that. It's part of my job to follow you. That's how I learn things.
Why don't you try it with your hat off? Now, you look here, Mr. Pepper. I won't be able to give you a single minute while I'm in Buxton. My business here is extremely confidential.
Yes, I know. Anthony Street.
Mr. Street, identity is a secret.
Look, Miss Ainsley, my assignment isn't Anthony Street. It's you. Now, do we catch that 5:30 for New York?
Sorry, but I've just made an appointment to see the Dean of Buxton College at exactly 5:30. Goodbye, Mr. Pepper. I beg your pardon, Dean Schaefer, but Professor Cobb is here now.
Professor Cobb?
Something to do with Miss Ainsley, wasn't it?
Miss Gilbert, do you realize that from what Miss Ainsley said, I have reason to believe that a certain novel was written on the campus of Buxton College?
Not the whirlwind?
Yes.
Dean Schaefer, no.
Miss Gilbert, I have further suspicions. Send in Professor Cobb.
You wanted to see me, Dean Schaefer?
Professor Cobb, have you heard of a book called The Whirlwind?
The Whirlwind? Yes, sir. A romantic work. Quite popular, I believe.
I've heard that it's unadulterated trash.
Oh, I wouldn't say that.
What's more, I have a strong suspicion it was written by a member of this faculty under the pen name of Anthony Street. Oh, it's unthinkable. A piece of tripe, like the whirlwind originating in Buxton.
I don't think tripe is exactly a fair word, sir. Too many people have found this book important.
Oh, there.
Little people, sir. Thousands of them living out their humdrum, sordid lives, to whom the adventure and excitement of this book are a relief and a boon. And this same book will be filmed. Do you know how many people are waiting to see it? 80 million. 80 million little people, sir, seeking escape and happiness.
I thought so. Anthony Street, you!
Yes, sir! Anthony Street!
Mr. Pepper, what is this second sight that makes you catch the same train to New York I'm taking?
No second sight at all. No other train. Let's get aboard.
Miss Ainsley!
Professor Cobb!
Miss Ainsley, does your offer still hold?
About doing the whirlwind? You've changed your mind?
Well, some unexpected circumstances lead me to reconsider. I thought if your offer is still open...
Get on the train!
But my thing?
Mr. Pepper will lend you whatever you need. Won't you, Mr. Pepper?
Who, me?
Well, that's very kind of you.
Come on, Mr. Pepper. Well, for heaven's sake.
Yeah, you win.
What's the matter?
Look at Mr. Pepper.
I am looking at Mr. Pepper.
He's got his hat off.
It's rather late at night now, and in New York, the entire Ainsley staff has hastily assembled in Carol's penthouse. The chief herself has just walked in the door with a tall, handsome, thoroughly bewildered Professor Cobb.
Here we are, everybody. Meet Mr. Anthony Street, the whirlwind.
How do you do?
Well, now, I won't keep you long, but we've got to work fast. Oh, Timmy, this is Miss Timmons, my secretary. Mr. Street.
How do you do?
Timmy, wire Hollywood right away. Tell them we've definitely found the right man for the whirlwind to be delivered on the agreed date. Don't tell them anything else. Oh, Ed, this is Mr. Clark, our photographer.
How do you do?
Hey, what a guy.
Ed, we're going to need publicity pictures and fast. Now, everything concerning Mr. Street is to be handled right here under my personal supervision. Is that clear? Oh, Ruth, this is Miss Fenwick, our instructor in dramatics. Mr. Street?
Well, Mr. Street.
Ruthie, he's got to learn to read lines right away. I want him to make a screen test in 10 days. Where's Pat? Oh, there you are. Pat O'Shea is one of our key men, Mr. Street.
How do you do?
Oh, you don't know how glad I am to know you.
Pat, get Tony Williams to measure him for a suit. Make it brown, double-breasted,
right.
English straight.
I would suggest
Where's
that
Richie?
I...
Oh, Richie. Richie, you've got to get him in condition. 2 hours a day in the gym.
Yes, ma'am. We'll show him, Mr. Street.
Well, you'd all better go home and get a good night's rest, and maybe the last one for some time. Thank you very much for coming. Well, Professor, we're underway.
Yes, I'd better get along to a hotel.
Hotel? Oh, you're staying here.
Here?
You've got work to do. It's most important that you stay near me.
Yes, but well, I mean...
And there's a guest suite that my clients use. I think you'll find it's both isolated and comfortable. Oh, Minna, are Mr. Street's rooms ready?
Oh, yes, Miss.
Miss Ainsley, I had no idea of staying here. I mean...
Oh, now, look here. This isn't Buxton. Run along now and don't worry. Better show him the way, Minna.
Well, good night, Miss Ainsley.
Mr. Ainsley? I'm impressed.
Pepper!
I'm deeply impressed.
I wondered where you were.
Yes, your staff let me in just now as they were leaving.
Well, I'll have to speak to them about it in the morning.
Say, how did you do this, Miss Ainsley? Get the professor out of Buxton?
Well, I'm afraid that will have to remain a trade secret.
Mm-hmm.
Shall we just put it down to charm?
Charm, huh? The velvet glove on top and underneath the brass knuckles.
Oh, I never show my knuckles. You'd better run along, Mr. Pepper. I have a tough day ahead. I'm working against the deadline, you know.
Yes, so am I. And until you give me 15 minutes, I can't even start.
Well, if I do give you 15 minutes, do I stand a reasonable chance of not finding you underfoot every time I turn around?
Yeah, a reasonable chance, yes.
All right. Well, now, what do you want to know?
Well, let's start at the beginning. How about your childhood?
Oh, I had a divine childhood. It's glorious.
Oh, well, I'm sorry it was as bad as all that.
Now, see here, Pepper. You asked a question and I answered it.
Miss Ainsley, your mother was Cora Ainsley, a great actress. Your father is Senator Ainsley.
Oh, I get it, Doctor. Poor little rich girl left alone day after day in her own private swimming pool. No, thank you. I'm not having any of it.
Okay. What sort of childhood did you have?
It was very stimulating, having both one's parents so successful. All their friends were brilliant, talented, writers, musicians.
Exactly. And do you know what I think, Miss Ainslie? I think that ever since you were a child, you've had to prove something. Carol Ainslie had to be somebody. It was expected of her.
Very interesting, Doctor. When do you throw on the colored slides?
And furthermore, you wanted success in a hurry, so you took other people, developed their abilities, sold them high, and made their second-rate talents pass for pure genius.
And what's so wrong with that?
Only one thing, that in all your hurry, you overlooked doing a job on yourself.
Oh. I don't exist, is that it?
Well, about 10% of you does. And I think, given a chance, the other 90 might be, well, terrific. Good night, Miss Ainslie.
Morning, Pat.
Well, where are those photographs of Anthony Street?
Here. Say, was that guy's mother frightened by a camera?
Oh, I see what you mean. Oh, well, he just lacks confidence. How was he in dramatic truth?
You really want the truth?
Oh, bad as that, huh?
Well, it's only the first day. We've got to get a screen test in 10 days.
Hey, how about giving us some more time, Carol?
We've promised David Arthur that we'd have that screen test out in Hollywood by the 27th. Oh, incidentally, if Mr. Henry Pepper shows his face around
here... Yeah.
Oh, never mind. Just keep him away from Anthony Street.
Oh, hiya, Professor. How's it going?
Hello, Mr. Pepper.
Oh, like that, huh? Say, where is everybody?
Back there. Miss Ainslie's projection room.
Oh, yes, they're looking at your screen test, huh?
Yeah. Again. Mr. Pepper, I am not a film actor.
Well, does it matter? Say, it sounds like they're about finished.
I hope so. I couldn't stand it. Nobody said a word, but I could tell what they were thinking.
Well, that's all, folks. Bright and early in the morning. Well, Michael, awful ordeal, wasn't it? Seeing yourself on the screen for the first time.
Yes, please.
Ah, don't worry. You'll be amazed at the improvement in your next test.
Next test?
Yes, yes, of course. Mr. Pepper, did I have an appointment with you?
Well, you told me to come around any evening I was ready.
I told you to telephone first, and
Miss Ainslie, ask for making another
Michael,
test.
Michael, please, this is not the time.
Well, I could leave.
I am not an actor. I can never be an actor.
Oh, not an actor, not an actor, not an actor. What are actors? Simply people. And what's acting? Simply being people.
Well, if there's a train back to Buxton tonight, I'm going to take it.
We'll be back for more of the Golden Age of Radio in just a moment.
Get growing. Get growing. You can count the difference when you're growing.
Cromwell Savings Bank of Cromwell.
Need a car loan to take advantage of those end-of-season price tags on new automobiles? Then see the folks at Cromwell Savings Bank. They'll help you purchase that new car quickly and easily. And if a personal loan is what you want, they can arrange that, too. In fact, Cromwell Savings can help you with all your financial needs, because they're a complete family banking service. See the friendly, accommodating folks at Cromwell Savings Bank, Main and West Streets in Cromwell.
You grow more with us.
Cromwell Savings Bank of Cromwell.
Cromwell Savings Bank, member FDIC, open Monday through Wednesday, 9 to 3, Thursdays 9 to 5, and Fridays 9 to 7:30 p.m. Once again, Dick Bertel.
Our guest tonight on the Golden Age of Radio is Bob Cummings. Well, let's make the transition now from radio to television. And that happened for you in the early days of television. I keep emphasizing the early days of radio.
1874.
You did miss the silence, didn't you, Bob, by the way?
Yes, I did.
Okay. I want to make sure that we didn't get the wrong impression here.
But I'm trying to think of the name of the TV show. I know, Ed, you know it, but I can't think of it. But I do remember the opening line.
My show?
Yeah, on TV.
Hold it, you're going to like this picture.
You're going to like this picture, yeah.
It was a very hard name to remember. I don't know why they named the show that. It was called The Bob Cummings Show.
Oh, that's right.
That's a rough one. But you can be forgiven for not knowing, because later on, when they're releasing it again around the country,
are they?
As an oddity, the show was called Love That Bob in syndication.
Oh, yes. Yes, I remember that title.
There was one before that, too.
And MCA owns it, and they release it little by little, and I don't know whether it's to keep me from living or what it is.
Yeah, I have some of his early shows in My Hero, which preceded that, which was quite a good show.
Where
John Mitel.
Robert S. Beanblossom.
Yes, that's right. Where'd you get a name like that, anyway?
I made it up. I made it up. I was looking
good at it, you know.
Yeah, I'd rather have the English name instead. But, was that to make the character a little weird or something like that, to get a name like that, so he'd be a little eccentric?
Well, the name was Jim Bullitt in the script. And to me, Jim Bullitt is not a funny name.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think. Sounds more like, well, later on, who was the guy who played Bullitt?
McQueen.
McQueen played Bullitt. You see, it has a blunt sort of stark quality to the name Jim Bullitt. I said, why Jim Bullitt? And they said, well, is it funny? I said, it's not funny. And so they said, well, then pick your own name. So I picked Robert S. Beanblossom. Why, I don't know.
Well,
but it stuck.
It still survived today.
And the thing that was funny about that show was I wrote one of the first episodes in it and played it, and it became the
pilot?
The pilot. And in the end, I had put a thing in there where I kissed the girl, who's this beautiful red-haired secretary that I'm in love with, and I'm a real estate man. And I kiss her, and smoke comes out of my ears. Well, people would wait until the end of that show each week. In fact, they didn't put that end on until after the Philip Morris commercial. I've always had cigarette sponsors, not being a smoker.
Playhouse 90, I see you've got listed here, Ed. That would indicate that, Bob, you were on one of the great TV shows. Do you happen to remember how many you did?
Seems to me I did two or three. The one that stands out in my mind...
It's Bomber's Moon, I bet, isn't it?
Bomber's Moon stands out because it was up for an award and why not, didn't get it. But we did get an award for another one in New York, Studio One.
Mm-hmm.
Studio One, 12 Angry Men. And that got an award for everybody. Felix Jackson, the producer, and the director, and Reggie Rose, who wrote it, and myself... Well, everybody got an award on that.
That was a great show. And, of course, if you were used to live radio, you had to be used to the pressures that were placed upon you with live television, were you?
Yes, except when the enormity of it hit you. What was it, an hour and a half show?
90 minutes, and it was all live. It was
90
no tape.
Minutes, and when that red light went on and that finger pointed, you knew... Well, here goes nothing.
And that's sometimes the feeling that you have.
Much harder than a stage play because, you may have four or five different sets you have to keep coming back and forth to.
Not only that, if a prop breaks, as we had on that show, a door would not open. Somebody had latched the darn thing. I've forgotten how we got out of it. Marty Balsam and myself got out of it, but it threw me for a minute. And then sometimes a camera will blow up. I don't mean blow up, but it would just stop working. And they'll have to, and you'll hear all this scraping and everything, and all the cables are being pulled, and the fellow's shoving in another camera, and you think, who's watching this door?
You ever have a situation where one of the cast members didn't show up for the live performance for some reason or other that ever happened?
Oh, actors.
You've been lucky then. That didn't happen.
Did you have that?
No, but I've heard of it happening, but it didn't happen to you ever.
I want to tell you, there's a breed of man and woman that exists in this world today in show business. Actors. You can say what you want about them. They are the most dependable human beings on Earth, with the possible exception of airline pilots. They really are there when they're supposed to be there. They may not do what they're supposed to do, but they get there.
Mm-hmm.
Actors are a strange breed. There is a discipline in the theater that just doesn't really exist anywhere else because there's no second take. That audience is out there, and there's a certain do-or-die thing about it. I don't know why it should be that way, but it is. They have a loyalty to their work. They do something that's interesting. I've seen it for years, and I do it myself. It's self-hypnotism. And I've had a hard time. One of the hard things in my life has been able to convince my beautiful, gorgeous Chinese wife, who is half my age and twice my smart, that I am really not myself when I'm playing a show like that. I said, you have to watch me. You have to put the right suit out and tell me where I am, if you're helping me dress or whatever it is, because I may go into the wrong thing. And so there is a self hypnotism quality there that's, what do they call them, parapsychology. But there is a quality that happens on the stage, and quite often you'll be playing with an actor, and he's completely hypnotized. And if you do it right, you hypnotize the audience.
And that's the key. We usually
hypnotize our wonderful publicist who works with us.
We usually ask our guests, Bob, if you had your druthers here and you'd like to hear one show or an excerpt from one show other than something in which you played.
Jack Benny was the godfather, or is the godfather, of my oldest boy, who is almost 30 now and is a doctor in Tulane, Robert Richard Cummings. And Jack, of course, I worked with only in one or two instances during my life, but on the first show that he did, which none of us hardly remember. But the longest laugh in history, I believe, was Jack Benny's long, long, long laugh. Do you remember that?
I've heard about it. I've never heard it.
Oh, you recall the incident? Is this the one where he was being held up by a hold-up man? And
Your money or your life?
I think I do have that one.
The man said, your money or your life, and he paused, and the audience paused and were convulsed, and people couldn't get their breath because this man was actually toying with the idea.
He had a choice.
Was so cheap that his life wasn't worth what...
Broadcasting from New York City, the Lucky Strike program, starring Jack Benny with Mary Livingston, Bill Harris, Rochester, Dennis Day, and filling in for little old fatty Don Wilson is yours truly, Kenny Delmar.
George Burns was my partner when I produced the Bob Cummings Show, and was a tremendous help to me. And, of course, George kills Jack. George just walks in the room and points at Jack, and Jack falls off the sofa and drops his drink and knocks over a bunch of flowers. He just goes absolutely limp at anything that George does.
George, marvelous.
Of course, a very good friend.
Yeah. Bob Cummings, thank you so much for being with us tonight on the Golden Age of Radio. It's been great fun.
Thank you so much, and it was wonderful to be here. I'd like to come back tomorrow.
Well, we'll have you back tomorrow. Until next time, this is Dick Bertel.
This is Ed Corcoran.
Good night.
Tony Home Permanent presents...
This is Nora Drake.
Buck Rogers in the 25th. Injury.
The Golden Age of Radio has been brought to you by WTIC and Cromwell Savings Bank, an equal housing lender, located at Main and West Streets in Cromwell. Your hosts were Ed Corcoran and Dick Bertel. Engineers for tonight's program were Sam Balnius and Bob Schirego. The Golden Age of Radio was produced by Bill Grasty.
Service stations and dealers in all our 48 states present for your entertainment Eddie Duchin and his music. Graham McNamee. And Edwin, the fire...